It is my pleasure now to introduce our own Deb Barton, who is going to be our speaker for this morning. She is a member of the Regina Unitarian Fellowship and the Sunday Service Committee. She is married to Ed Barton and has been for 40 years, and is mother to Chantel, Marshall, and Tyler Barton, and has a number of grandchildren, and I understand also is the proud owner of an entertaining black lab. Retired in 2015 with 30 plus years service of the federal government, and I understand now enjoys camping, the peacefulness of nature, reading, and cooking. Deb.
So needless to say, I'm a little nervous, so please bear with me. This presentation is part of the famous Unitarian series and is about James Reeb, who was an American Unitarian Universalist minister and civil rights activist. While participating in Selma's voting right movement in Selma, Alabama in 1965, he was murdered by white segregationists, dying of head injuries in a hospital 2 days after being severely beaten. He was a truly compassionate man that proved that no matter the race of a person, we all have the obligation to work together and live together in peace and equality. The resource information I use today for this presentation is from the UUA organization site, and excerpts from the book, The Martyrs, 16 Who Gave Their Lives for Racial Justice by Jack Mendelson, and the American History Channel series on PBS and the Boston Globe. James Reeb was born January 1, 1927, the only child of Harry and May Reeb of Wichita, Kansas. He was raised in a loving home with strict Presbyterian beliefs. When he attended sophomore in high school, his family moved to Casper, Wyoming, where Jim attended school right up to the time of his graduation. Upon graduation, he enlisted in the U.S. Infantry and served with them for approximately 18 months. He then returned to Casper to make a decision about his future education, and he worked in his local church during the summer months. During this time, he met his wife-to-be, Marie Deason, and after attending St. Olaf's College in Minnesota, he married Marie. Academically, he flourished and then was accepted into the Princeton Theological Seminary in Princeton, New Jersey, to prepare himself for the Presbyterian ministry. After graduation, he obtained a position with the Philadelphia General Hospital as a salaried Presbyterian chaplain. He soon recognized that he was more interested in pastoral work than preaching. His approach was more, "What are your needs and how can I help you?" than, "Well, here I am and I have come to pray for you." The more he immersed himself into people's actual problems, the more he questioned his role as a Presbyterian theologian. This is the beginning of James questioning his faith. He began a journey of exploring religious alternatives, and after reading a book by religious educator and Unitarian Sophia Lyon Foss, and attending various Unitarian fellowships and churches with Marie, they converted to Unitarianism. James became a Unitarian minister and served at the All Saints, All Souls congregation in a racially mixed neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and he became an avid leader in trying to break through barriers that did not allow African Americans to obtain adequate housing and employment. A few years later, James and his family moved to Boston, Massachusetts, to work with the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC, a Quaker-based organization, in hopes of improving the housing situation for low-income African American people in the Boston area. James felt so strongly about helping these people that he and his family moved into the so-called slum area of Boston and had their children attend the impoverished and oppressed school within this neighborhood. He felt this was the only way to live and experience how poverty and injustice affected those who lived there. James' calling to Selma, Alabama, began on March 7, 1965. That evening, him and Marie turned on the 11 o'clock news and watched in horror as to what was unfolding in front of their eyes. More than 500 black activists gathered to march for their rights to vote. The march was to begin from the outskirts of Selma to the state capital of Montgomery, Alabama. Carrying bags and small suitcases, holding extra clothing, shoes, and sandwiches, they started their 50-mile walk for this cause. Once they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they encountered a human wall of state troopers and police led by Jim Clark, Selma's notoriously known county sheriff, who wore his beliefs of segregation on his sleeve, courtesy of a pin that said, "Never." The marchers were ordered to halt and to disperse, and in return, they asked if they might pray. A charge was ordered by the law enforcement, and as Gay Talese, a reporter from the New York Times, wrote, quote, "The sounds of plastic helmets and wood crashing flesh, strange sounds, clack, clump, clock, followed by the cries of the Negroes falling to the highway. The cheers of white locals watching on the side of the road, the hoofs click of nervous horses mounted by a sheriff's posse, anxious to get into the act. The ticking of television cameras recording this whole scene, to be spun around the world and boomerang right back to Selma. This day was known to be Bloody Sunday." Monday, March 8th, 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King put out a call to all people of faith and activism across America to come to Selma to march against the violence that was racially sparked the day before. James heard Dr. King's plea, and after a discussion with Marie regarding concerns of his safety, it was decided that he should join this march also. The second march held in Selma was led by Dr. King, and across the Edmund Pettus Bridge they went again. However, this time, Dr. King stopped the march and had the group kneel, pray, and sing, "We Shall Overcome," and then turned around and retreated. This name day was to be known as Turnaround Tuesday. Once returning into the city limits, James and two other Unitarian ministers, Orloff Miller and Clark Olson, headed off to Walker's Cafe, a predominantly black restaurant. However, that day it was bustling with crowds of activists and clergy. After their meals and phone calls home to their families, they headed back down to Brown's Chapel to meet with the other marchers to discuss the day's events and possible future actions. They did not make it there. As they were walking down the street, 4 to 5 white men were calling out racial slurs. With their voices thick with hate, they attacked the three ministers with their fist, boots, and a club. James was hit with a heavy club to his head. When the attack was over, James laid on the pavement, seriously injured. He was taken to the Birmingham Hospital, and President Lyndon Johnson was made aware of this development and had Marie and James' father flown to Birmingham to be by James' side. James died March 11th, 1965. This brutality was not new to the people of Alabama, as 2 weeks before, a young black man, Jimmy Lee Jackson, was shot to death while trying to protect his mother from a vicious beating by police officers during a civil rights march. However, it took the death of a white person to have the nation's issues of voters' rights to be addressed by the federal government. In Washington, President Lyndon Johnson addressed the nation with these words and stated he was sending a voting rights bill to Congress. Quote, "What happened in Selma was an American tragedy. At times, history and the fate meeting at a single time in a single place to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was in Lexington and Concord. So it was the last week in Selma, Alabama. It's not just Negroes. It's really all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice." And then he stated, "We shall overcome." In conclusion, I would like to quote the last paragraph from Dr. Luther King's eulogy for James Reeve. Quote, "So we thank God for the life of James Reeve. We thank God for the goodness. We thank God that he was willing to lay down his life in order to redeem the soul of our nation. So I say, so Horatio said as he stood over the dead body of Hamlet, good night, sweet prince. May the flight of angels take thee to thy internal rest." And thanks for the opportunity to present this series on James Reed. I do have a little bit more information before we have any questions or comments that you may find of interest. The three men that were Elmer Cook, William Stanley Hoggle, Naaman O'Neill Hoggle, and they were tried for the murder of James Reeve, but the all-white jury acquitted the trio despite testimony identifying the attackers. This was known as Southern justice, fueled by racism and bigotry of that time. Also, Marie Reeve moved her family and her 4 children back to Wyoming and eventually remarried. And there's also been a congregation in Madison, Wisconsin, that the founders chose the name as their commitment to social justice and inherent worth and dignity of every person, and they named the congregation the James Reeb Congregation. And I'd just like to provide a little bit more information that may help with any comments or discussions. Before the Voters' Right to Vote Act was put in place, there was a Civil Rights Act, but that hadn't solved the voting problem. What it did do, it allowed black people to check into hotels if they desired, sit on buses whenever they wished, and eat in any restaurant. But in much of the South, blacks still couldn't vote. In 1964, when black people tried to register to vote in Alabama and Mississippi or some other southern states, they were likely to be beaten or to lose their jobs. Even though the 15th Amendment stated that every citizen had the right to vote, those who kept trying to register were given impossible questions to answer and were asked to pay a poll tax that they couldn't afford. So that's what led up to the act that Lyndon Johnson wanted to be put in place. So thank you for having me, and if you have any questions or comments, I'll try to help.
Thank you very much, Deb. And I don't know if there are any questions or comments. I do have the microphone, so if...
Deb, I think you did a fabulous job, and I'd just like to make a comment that I recently read a book that suggested that a lot of things have not changed. The book is Just Mercy, and it's about one lawyer's work, a black lawyer, and subsequently the work of a group that gets together to defend people who are in the justice system. And the number of people who are just sort of thrown into jail for nothing with no real evidence and who are subject to... I can't remember which... I think it was Alabama, but I'm not sure. I may be wrong about that, but it's in the South, whatever. And the writer of the book, whose name escapes me as well, is a black man. And it's an excellent book, and it gives you a real sense of how much injustice continues, and people are sort of end up being hanged for taken to the electric chair for nothing in many cases, simply because they're black. So it's Just Mercy is the title, and as I said, the name of the author, somebody with a phone can maybe find it out for me. It is absolutely worth reading, and gives you a sense that some things have changed, but a lot hasn't. And thank you, Deb. As I said, it was a fabulous job. What shall I do with this?
Thank you, Deb. I mean, tears. I think I'm not the only one who had tears in their eyes, in my eyes. And it's quite interesting because nothing changed. Black lives matter. Mm-hmm. And when you see going to the court, hang jury, innocent, hang jury, innocent, 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 innocent. It is, nothing changed.
Yeah.
And it is sad, even though we may say we're in 2016, racism rampant when you see this particular candidate who goes and see if I were to shoot somebody in the middle of New York City, basically I would be free.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Still disturbing.
Very, very disturbing. I'm so glad as an immigrant I'm in Canada.
Yes.
Thank you.
I've just gotten off the plane and my ears and my eyes are not quite right. And just a couple of comments. One is that the right to vote is now being taken away from black people. As probably many of you know, through a picture ID. A lot of people do not drive in the South. They're too poor, especially a lot of black people. And when they require a picture, it means that they have to get into town somehow or other and get one from some agency, or they are unable to vote. And it sounds like such a minor thing. Well, if you don't have a picture to prove that you are who you are and where you live, should you have the right to vote? But it's not that simple at all. And the other thing that I to me makes a lot of sense, it's as Bruno says, things really have not changed much. And until they change economically, which was one of the things that I think Martin Luther King came to very late in his life, and it was the last few months of his life in which he said, this is about economic freedom and about being able to get out of poverty. And so far that hasn't happened. We don't have lynchings, but we don't have freedom down there either.
Thank you, Deb. That was really very interesting. A couple of things. I really appreciated when you started out, you gave your references before you started. And for me, that put everything else in perspective, and I just really appreciated that. Another thing that I was just a little curious about was as we were writing this and making connections to today, mm-hmm. what were your thoughts and feelings as you went through the writing process?
For instance, this morning, my husband and I were watching CBC News, and a little typing at the bottom, they brought up about, I wasn't aware of this, and I should have been, but in 1960, here in Canada, was the first time that Aboriginal people were able to vote. So I found that, you know, quite disturbing that in a land that we moved and took from them, that they didn't have a right to vote on anything. And there again, the problem with voting even to this day, in Canada even, is that a lot of people don't have the proper identification. A lot of First Nation peoples that live on reserve don't have identification, so or picture ID. So even here in Canada, we see the same things that in the States are reflected within the black community. I found it also disturbing when I was writing it that I'm more of a socialist here, NDP, liberal, but down there I would be considered myself a Democrat. And when I was doing the resource information, it came to my attention that the governor, George Wallace of Alabama, was also a Democrat. And I'll just maybe just read this little thing, because I found it so disturbing, because I thought, how could this person be put into this political party? But I'll just read this briefly. George Wallace took the oath of office in January 1463 as the governor of Alabama. He strongly believed in segregation, and in his inaugural speech he had said, quote, "In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss a gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever." And that just, it really hurt my soul to think that this was coming from a Democratic elected person of their government in Alabama. So those are the types of things that when I was doing this, that it really affected me. Plus, I watched the movie Selma. If anybody has not watched that movie, they really should. It is extraordinary.
Deb, I'm over here. Thank you so much. That was very interesting. I found Hillary's book, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, book by Brian Stevenson. Brian Stevenson. Yeah. And I just wanted to reiterate some of what you've said in terms of making the connection with all people of race in Canada, and particularly First Nations people. I mean, if we just look in Regina and went north central, mm-hmm. and we all turn a blind eye to that, I think. Mm-hmm. But it really should not be tolerated. And mm-hmm. we have elected all kinds of democratic governments who've done very little to help and improve the situation. I do think things are slowly improving. Mm-hmm. That new school that's being built, I think, is supposed to be sort of a multi-service, you know,
yeah.
and multifaceted, and helping the whole family, not just the children.
Right.
I mean, there are some good organizations here, but there's not enough done, and certainly not for the northern communities.
Yes.
It appears that that's all for this morning. Thank you very, very much for your very, very thoughtful presentation.
Okay, thank you very much.